Good morning. My name is Spencer Ehrman. My pronouns are he and him, and I'd like to welcome you to West Hills Unitarian Universalist Fellowship this morning. I get to be your lay leader, or you get to have me as your lay leader. I think it's important before we launch to focus and center on what we have here. The chaos that is out in the world for the last 24 hours is, there's not a lot we can do about that here. So if we can focus our attention on our community, on our visitors and guests, on what we're building here for the next hour, that might be easier. So welcome. Whoever and wherever you are at this moment, whether you're online or in the room, we want you to know that you're welcome here, regardless of your age or your abilities, color of your skin or where you were born, regardless of who you love or how you identify your gender, if you do. I'd like to welcome our guests and visitors, whether you're with us personally or virtually. For those here, let's take a minute to look around and greet our neighbors, especially those we don't already know. Thank you all. Please take your seats. Nora, if you'll come up and light our chalice for us, please. We join today this day with loving hearts, hands, and minds. Embracing the interconnected web of water, air, and earth to create a new world not of wealth, but of well-being. And as we give thanks for this earth, our shared and singular home, may we dedicate ourselves to its ongoing care. Please join in saying our affirmation. Let us open our eyes to see what is beautiful and wondrous. Let us open our minds to learn what is true and what is mysterious. Let us open our hearts to love one another and our neighbors. This is from Lynn Unger. Imagine with me for a moment. Don't worry, I'm not saying it's real. Imagine, if you can, that there's been not a calamity, but a great awakening. Pretend just for a moment that we all so loved our threatened earth that we stopped going on cruises, limited international flights, worked on cherishing the places that we already have, where we already are. In this pretty fantasy, everyone who possibly can stops commuting, spends the extra time with their kids or pets or garden. We have the revelation that everyone needs health care, sick leave, steady work. It occurs to us that health care workers are heroes, also teachers, not to mention the artists of all kinds who teach us resilience and joy. Imagine, if you will, that we turn to our neighbors in mutual aid, trading eggs for milk, checking in on those who are elderly or alone. Imagine that each of us felt suddenly called to wonder, in this moment, what does the world need from me? What are my gifts? Yeah, I know it's just a fantasy. The world could never change so radically overnight. But imagine.
Thank you.
Thank you, choristers. Thank you, John. I'm not wearing a hat, but I'm wearing several today anyway. Hats in spirit. I'm grateful for the choristers and for the opportunity that they offer to get to sing. And this is the time in our service when we pause to reflect on the gifts we've received from this abundant earth, the generous spirit of family and community, to consider what it is that we have given and what it is we're grateful for. During the musical interlude, please consider the gifts you have to offer our community, whether it be financial support or the special gift of your time and talent, knowing that we're grateful for your offering. And please remember that it's love that built our community, love that built the fires that warm us and planted the trees that shade us. We drink from wells that we did not dig, and we are ever grateful for all the early stewards of this land, beginning with original peoples, indigenous tribes, many of whom live among us today, and to whom our doors are always open. WIF exists because of the generous spirit and commitment of all those who came before us, just as our future health depends on the dedication and commitment of those here now. So if our greeters could please come and pass our offering baskets amongst us. Thank you all. Please join in our expression of gratitude. Let us be grateful when we are able to give, for many do not have that privilege. Let us be grateful for all those who share their gifts with us, for we are enriched by their giving. And let us be grateful even for our needs, so that we may learn from the generosity of others.
Shall we sing the hymn 1074, Turn the World Around?
Turn the world around. Oh, sorry. Turn the world around. Liz? Cool.
Good morning, everybody. My name's Liz. Some people call me Izzy. I'm the DRE here at WOOF. My pronouns are less important than you think that they are. And today's story is a story I chose because I remember reading this book when I was a kid. And it stuck with me for the last 30 years. And I think it really goes with the theme that we're talking about today. I just think there's so much that happens to us in childhood, and we never know what's going to stick, right? And that's what we're trying to do here at WOOF with our family ministry and our religious education. We want to teach our youth about the values and traditions that we hold dear in our faith and hope that no matter where they end up in their lives, there are things that stick with them. We've had a lot of change at WOOF in the RE program over the last year, and I want to invite anyone who's interested in what we're doing or wants to help out, support the kids or the families, you can reach out to me or other members of the RE committee after the service during coffee hour. And for kids, you should know that your voice matters too here at WOOF, and the children ages 6 and up have formed a youth council, and today the youth council is meeting in the Acorn Room after the service to discuss our covenant and our next fundraiser. And today's story is called Just a Dream by Chris Van Allsburg. As usual, Walter stopped at the bakery on his way home. He ate one large jelly-filled donut as quickly as he could, licked his fingers, and crumpled up an empty bag and threw it at a fire hydrant. At home, he saw Rose, the girl next door, watering a tree. "I got it for my birthday," she said proudly. Walter couldn't understand why anyone would want a dumb tree for their birthday. After dinner, Walter took out the trash. Three cans stood next to the garage. One was for bottles and cans, one was for the garbage, one was for the lawn clippings. Walter just dumped everything into one can. He didn't have time to sort through it. There was something good on TV. Walter went to bed thinking about the show he had watched on TV. Everybody had a tiny, had their own tiny airplane. Robots did all your chores. There were machines that could make any food you wanted. He wished he could live in the future. He couldn't wait to have his own tiny plane. He couldn't wait for a robot to take out the trash for him. He couldn't wait to make jelly donuts by the thousands. He fell asleep, and his wish came true. Walter's bed traveled to the future. Walter woke up in the middle of a huge dump. A bulldozer was pushing a heap of bulging trash bags towards him. "Stop!" he yelled. The man stopped for a moment. Walter looked at the distant mountains of trash, saw half-buried houses. He looked up. A few feet away from his bed was a rusty old street sign that read Floral Avenue. "Oh, no," Walter gasped. He lived on Floral Avenue. The driver revved his bulldozer, and Walter pulled the covers over his head. "This can't be the future," he thought. "It's just a dream." He went back to sleep, but not for long. Walter peered over the edge of his bed, and it was stuck in the branches of a tall tree. Down below, he could see two men carrying a large saw. They rolled up their sleeves and got to work, back and forth, pushing the saw, slicing through the trunk of Walter's tree. "You must need this tree for something important," he called down. "Oh, yes," the men said, "very important." And Walter noticed the letters on their jackets, which read, "Quality Toothpick Company." Walter sighed and slid back under the blankets. He woke up and he couldn't stop coughing. His bed was balanced on the rim of a giant smokestack. The air was filled with smoke. It burned his throat. It made his eyes itch. All around him were clouds of hot, foul smoke. A workman climbed one of the stacks near him, and Walter called out, "What is this place?" "Oh, this is the Maximum Strength Medicine Factory," the man said. "They make wonderful medicine. It helps with burning throats and itchy eyes." Walter started coughing again. He buried his head in his pillow. When the coughing stopped, he fell back asleep. But he woke up with snowflakes falling on him. He was high in the mountains. A group of people wearing snowshoes and long fur coats were hiking past his bed. "Where are you going?" he asked. "To the hotel," they replied, and pointed to an enormous building with a sign on it that read, "Hotel Everest." "Isn't it beautiful?" they asked. Walter stared at the flashing yellow sign and crawled back under the sheets. But there was more to see. He woke up, and his hand was wet and cold, hanging over the edge of his bed. He opened his eyes and found himself floating upon the open sea. He was heading towards a fishing boat, and there were men on the boat laughing and cheering. "What's the celebration?" he asked when he got closer. "We've just caught a fish," one of them yelled. "Our second fish this week." He held up the very small fish for Walter to see. But Walter turned around, and soon the rocking of the waves put him back to sleep, but only for a moment, as a loud shrieking horn nearly lifted him off his mattress. He jumped up. There were cars and trucks everywhere. Every driver had a phone in their hand and a big cup of coffee in their other hand. When the traffic stopped, the honking grew louder. Walter couldn't get back to sleep. Hours passed, and he wondered if he'd be stuck on the highway forever. He pulled his pillow tightly around his head. This can't be the future, he thought. Where are all the tiny airplanes? Where are the robots doing chores? The honking continued into the night until finally Walter went to sleep, but his bed traveled on. When he looked up, a horse stood right by his bed, staring at him, and directly in the saddle was a woman wearing cowboy clothes. "My horse likes you," she said. Good, replied Walter, who wondered where he was this time. All he could see was a dull yellow haze. The woman spread her eyes wide. "This is the mighty Grand Canyon," she said. Walter gazed into the foggy distance. "Of course, with all the smog, nobody's gotten to look at it for years." But the woman offered to sell Walter some postcards that showed what the canyon looked like in the old days. He couldn't look at them. "It's just a dream," he told himself. "I'll wake up soon, back in my room." But he didn't. Walter looked out from under his sheets, and his bed was flying through the sky. A flock of ducks passed overhead, and one of them landed on the bed. And to Walter's surprise, it started to speak to him. "I hope you don't mind," the bird said, "if I take a short rest here. We've been flying for days looking for a pond we used to stop to eat at. I'm sure it's down here somewhere." Walter nodded, though he suspected that something awful might have happened. After a while, the duck waddled to the edge of the bed and flew off. "Good luck," Walter called, and pulled the blanket over his head. "It's just a dream," he whispered, and wondered if it would end. And finally it did. Walter's bed returned to the present. He was safe in his room, but he felt terrible. The future he had seen was not the one he expected. He looked out his window at the trees and the lawns and the early morning light, and he jumped out of bed and he ran outside and down the block still in his pajamas. He found the empty jelly donut bag that he'd thrown at the fire hydrant the day before. And then Walter went back home, and before the sun came up, he sorted all the recycling out of the trash can. A few days later was Walter's birthday. All his friends came over for cake and ice cream. They loved all his new toys, the laser, the electric yo-yo, the inflatable dinosaurs. "My best present," Walter told them, "is outside." And he showed them the gift that he had picked out, a tree. And after the party, Walter and his dad planted the tree. When he went to bed, he looked out the window. He could see his tree and the tree that Rose had planted. He liked the way they looked side by side. And he went to sleep, but not for long. Because that night, Walter's bed took him away again. And when he woke up, his bed was standing in the shade of two very tall trees. The sky was blue, laundry was hanging from a clothesline, and a man pushed a motorless lawnmower across a yard. "This isn't the future," he thought. "This has to be the past." "Good morning," said the man. "You've found a nice place to sleep." "Yes, I have," Walter agreed. There was something very peaceful about the big trees next to his bed. The man looked up at the rustling leaves. My great-grandmother planted one of those trees, he said. Walter looked up at the leaves and realized where his bed had taken him. It was the future. I like it here, he told the man, and he drifted off to sleep in the shade of the two giant trees that he and Rose had planted so many years ago. All right. Now, if we want to stand and form arches across the walkways, we'll sing the children to their classes.
Good old Walter. When I look around at our community, I'm filled with joy and gratitude. There's so much happiness in this world. We're so privileged that we get to be here together in our space. Goodness, love, and beauty grow within and all around us. Together here, we create a circle of celebration deep enough to hold all the joy in our lives. And there is so much pain in the world, too. Each of us knows loss and suffering. But together here, we create a circle of compassion wide enough to hold all the sorrow in our lives. Let us take now a moment of silent reflection. When the music begins, please come forward if you feel moved to do so and place a stone in the bowl of water. The water is the community of compassion that bears all the sorrows, and the water is the community of celebration that shares all the joys. If you do choose to come up, please approach from this aisle and return to your seats in the other. Place a final stone in the water to represent all the joys and sorrows that have gone unsaid today. This passage is from the Ute Native people of North America. Earth, teach me courage as the tree which stands all alone. Earth, teach me freedom as the eagle soars in the sky. Earth, teach me to remember kindness as dry fields weep with rain. Please take a couple of moments in meditation, reflection, or prayer as your path dictates.
This next song that you're about to hear is not a familiar Beatles song to you. It might be because it was just released. And if you know that the Beatles are up in years and there's only two surviving members, you might also wonder, well, how is that possible? This song, Now and Then, was revived from a scratch track that John Lennon created, I think, in the year shortly before he died, after the Beatles had broken up. And it was handed to Paul by Yoko, Paul had thought, you know, this is a really good song, maybe we can record this, but the quality of the track wasn't very good. John recorded it sitting at the piano, singing and playing together. And so some years later, Paul and George and Ringo tried to record it, but it just wasn't successful because of the quality of the recording. Fast forward many years later, with the advancement of technology, AI in particular, they're able to separate the tracks. And though George had passed at this point, they actually had some tracks that George had written. So the recording that they produce includes all of the Beatles, and it's really a beautiful recording, as well as the message of now and then, and how we, you know, even when our ancestors have passed on or our friends, we still keep them in our hearts, and they help us get through all of life's trials together.
Yeah, that was the other hat I got to wear today. Congressional readings, findings, and declaration of purpose. 42 U.S.C., United States Code. The Congress finds that the predominant part of the nation's population is located in its rapidly expanding metropolitan and other urban areas, which generally cross the boundary lines of local jurisdictions and often extend into two or more states. That the growth in the amount and complexity of air pollution brought about by urbanization, industrial development, and the increasing use of motor vehicles has resulted in mounting dangers to the public health and welfare. That air pollution prevention and air pollution control at its source is the primary responsibility of the states and local governments, and that federal financial assistance and leadership is essential for the development of cooperative federal, state, regional, and local programs to prevent and control air pollution. The purposes of this subchapter are to protect and enhance the quality of the nation's air resources, to initiate and accelerate a national research and development program to achieve the prevention and control of air pollution, to provide technical and financial assistance to state and local governments, to encourage and assist the development and operation of regional air pollution prevention and control programs. That was the Clean Air Act, incredibly passed by Congress and signed by Richard Nixon in 1970. I've known Mary Pivato for 11 or 12 years. And in that time, I've had the privilege of watching Mary and her organization, Neighbors for Clean Air, make significant advancements in working in air pollution, specifically air toxics, reduction in not just the Portland Metro Airshed, but around the state. So I'm delighted to have Mary here to help us understand how air impacts us.
Do you know you have a calling, an epic calling, a heroic calling? It's probably grander than anything you would let yourself imagine outside your dreams. That's why you are here, alive in this time of great consequence. Good morning. That quote is from the prologue to Margaret Klein to Solomon's book, Facing the Climate Emergency, How to Transform Yourself with Climate Truth. It's a self-help book, and I encourage you all to read it. My name is Mary Pivato, Executive Director and Co-Founder of Neighbors for Clean Air, and I am so honored to be here this morning to speak with you. I want to give just one quick shout-out to your morning's audience in Minnesota, which is my family, sitting with my mother as she recovers from a stroke, and my thoughts are with them. But I'm also very grateful for that family, and particularly my mother and her constant and reminder in her life and the way she lived her life to always find that thing to dedicate it to. So thank you to them. But I also want to tell gratitude to Spencer as I start this morning to speak with you about how I found and answered that very calling 15 years ago. I am so grateful that when I met my friend and fellow advocate, Spencer Ehrman, I met him in the first years of the work to reduce air pollution in Oregon when he was at Portland City Club. It was not a small thing to have such an influential institution take on what was then a very obscure, unseen, massively ignored problem. His mobilizing was a significant contribution to how the issue of air quality transformed from the isolated rantings of a stay-at-home mom to one that reached and achieved great policy wins in our state capital. Back to that calling. Let's all take a breath. It's something we do 23,000 times a day, and we don't even think about it. It's fundamental to life. And as someone who gets easily overwhelmed by overthinking things, I never really thought about this until I started thinking about our global climate crisis in the context of each relatively tiny breath we take. So let me explain that with each breath, we take in about a half a liter of air. And adults do that at about 16 times a minute. The rate increases for all of us when we exercise, get stressed, or stand in front of a lot of people and speak. But children, and I have three children that were ages 3 to 12 at the inception of Neighbors for Clean Air. Children, my friend Paul told me, are like hummingbirds. They breathe faster all the time and take in more air relative to their small bodies. That means about 44 breaths a minute, or 63,000 times a day. And the human lung is a very simple apparatus, pretty much designed for clean air. It takes in oxygen and expels carbon dioxide. It evolved over the course of 200 to 300 million years in an environment that pretty much the only stuff it had to contend with was dust, pollen, animal dander, or the very large particulates created by fire. Because of this, we have very little to protect us. We have nose hairs, our cough reflex, and the production of mucus. And then, 300 years ago, humans started combusting coal and later fossil fuels, causing a dramatic increase in air pollution. Our bodies, like our climate, were ill-equipped to adapt to the rapid increase of smaller, more toxic particulates and gases in the atmosphere. What that means today, with each breath in the average city like Portland, Oregon, that half liter of air includes 50 million ultra-fine particulates. These are so small that they are inhaled deeply and break through the lungs into the bloodstream, where they are let loose to do irreparable damage to our heart, brain, and other organs. The World Health Organization says that 9 out of 10 people in the world breathe polluted air. It's responsible for 7 million deaths, making it the single largest threat to human health on the planet. This same global pollution threat we call soot, climate scientists call black carbon. Like carbon dioxide, it comes from burning gasoline and diesel and is the leading contributor to the climate crisis in Oregon, with transportation making up about 40% of climate pollution, and that's been rising for over the last decade. In Oregon, trucks and buses and delivery vans pump out nearly half of our climate pollution. Yet, these diesel vehicles are less than 10% of all the vehicles on the road. Even worse, they pump out 70% of the smog pollution, the nitrous oxides, and 64% of the black carbon particulate pollution. Climate scientists also tell us black carbon is the second largest contributor to climate warming after carbon dioxide. But unlike CO2, which can stay in the atmosphere for centuries, black carbon only remains in the air for days to weeks. That's the good news. Scientists have calculated that global reductions in that soot and black carbon could slow temperature rise by as much as 0.5 degrees Celsius by 2040. I'm going to repeat that because it's so important. If we reduce the black soot that comes primarily from diesel engines and coal, we can save millions of lives while simultaneously buying 15 years on the ticking climate catastrophe clock. This was a siren call I needed to see the work I could do to address our global climate crisis. I could take immediate action to reduce toxic pollution in our community, protect my children by reducing what is the single biggest contribution in Oregon to global warming. The secret is not thinking big, but thinking small. Which brings me to school lunches. I mentioned I have a tendency to overthink. And in spring of 2009, I couldn't handle making my daughter's school lunches every day and then opening their lunch boxes every evening, seeing the nearly untouched food. I obsessed over the waste, the excess single packaging, the toxic chemicals associated with food production, this growing evidence of methane emissions and carbon footprint of food production. And I long for the days when we lived in Italy when they ate freshly prepared meals in the school cafeteria. So one day after I got my children off to school, I grabbed my computer and turned to the internet to search for the farm-to-school lunch program, thinking this might be the perfect system-wide solution to my daily dilemma. But instead that day, I stumbled across a national study about industrial air pollution near American schools. I learned that the air quality around my daughter's school in Northwest Portland was ranked in the bottom 2% in the nation. My kids were not just not eating lunch. They were breathing air laden with toxic industrial heavy metals. I didn't set out in that moment to become a leader of a grassroots movement to reform air regulations in Oregon. Even as I saw myself becoming that, I didn't call myself an expert or leader. I called myself an accidental activist because me leading this movement was so unlikely. I didn't have a background in environmental law, science, or even community organizing. In many ways, I can now see that was my strength, because this was a problem, the answer to which I could oversimplify, not overthink. Our kids should breathe clean, not dirty air. But as many I'm sure in this room know, you don't become an activist because you discover a problem. You become an activist when you take action against that problem. I started what would become a statewide movement by simply talking with the people closest to me, my friends, my neighbors, fellow parents at school. I was sure that they just needed this information and they would be as shocked as I was, and our collective outrage would ensure that whoever was responsible for the dirty air would fix it. I started writing emails. I wrote letters to the editor. Emboldened by the initial response, and with the help of my friends, a lot of friends, we wrote a petition, and then I went out and I actually talked to people I didn't know. I stood at the school playground and in front of the local market, and in 3 months we delivered over 4,000 signatures from our community demanding clean air. Looking back now, and especially in the light of the overwhelming assault of existential threats we have all endured these last 4 to 5 years, I know I could have chosen differently in that first moment. I could have been overwhelmed by the complexity of the problem or just been really angry at the people and institutions I thought should be taking care of it. I could have focused on the really big reasons why there was no way we could solve this problem. The first I learned about was that the Clean Air Act that Spencer so eloquently introduced to us this morning, that despite the logical expectation of the laws governing our air, is in fact one of the most complex regulations that we have. And it does not directly limit pollutants from being actively emitted into our air. And so the company that was making the air unsafe for my children, our children, to breathe, was doing it legally and with the full permission from the state authority to do so. And those regulators, who I and my neighbors believe should have taken care of this, they weren't falling down on the job because they were incompetent or evil conspirators on the dole of big business in our state. They're honestly mostly underfunded. Anybody has kids in public schools, you know that problem. They lack the adequate resources to do their job well. And finally, this was 2009. Oregon was deep in the deep recession. Esco Steel, the industrial manufacturer identified as the chief contributor to air pollution near my daughter's schools, received a good citizen accolade from our governor that year for providing the family wage jobs that our state so desperately needed, even while knowingly dumping this toxic pollution in our neighborhoods. I didn't focus on all the reasons not to do this, however. I focused on the one reason I had to do it, because there is nothing accidental about a mother protecting her children. Heavy metals in the air could do irreversible damage to my daughters just by doing what they did 63,000 times a day, and I couldn't stop them from breathing. So I had to make sure that the air they breathed was clean. As our state regulators and elected officials sat unmoving on the sidelines, I took the only action that was going to make this happen. I called the environmental manager at the company that was named for causing the pollution. I invited him to meet me for coffee. 2 years later, he and I stood in front of a large gathering of our community to sign a document that committed ESCO to over $5 million in investments to reduce the toxic air pollutants that it was emitting into our neighborhood. 2 years after that, we did the same for the community in North Portland who lives above the shipyard on Swan Island, which emitted foul-smelling odors from its wastewater treatment and toxic emissions from the diesel engines on ships and equipment. Vigor agreed to require all of its customers, ships that dock for repair, to plug into clean electric energy rather than sit burning dirty bunker fuel while at berth. And in 2015, we took on Oregon's largest private employer, Intel, and secured over $250,000 in air monitoring to ensure that the emissions from the Hillsborough-based company was not putting neighbors at undue risk. At some point during those years, I was learning a little something about this. But mostly I learned that I found my calling. Maybe it found me. But my thing was air pollution. And people began to refer to me as an expert. I'm still surprised. And there were many more people from other communities who wanted the same thing, clean, safe air to breathe. There's a term in environmental activism, sure is not new to anyone here, called NIMBY, not in my backyard. But what I have found was maybe what one could call IMBYism. Maybe what we all need to do is look at the problem that is in our backyard or close to home, even if it seems relatively small. Because if you can find the fix, not only for your backyard, but the fix that ensures it doesn't land in anyone else's, then you're on to something that is big. In the 15 years since we founded Neighbors for Clean Air, besides helping those other communities negotiate their own agreements with industry neighborhoods, we also brought those communities together to form a movement for clean, safe air for everyone, everywhere. And while we still have a long way to go to ensure that, we have achieved some significant gains. In 2018, Oregon passed a landmark health-based program to regulate all industry, aimed at reducing risk for communities that live close to industrial polluters. That same year, the Oregon State Legislature passed the largest increase in the Department of Environmental Quality's budget in over 20 years, funding the newly adopted Cleaner Air Oregon program. In 2019, I had the privilege to stand next to our governor as she signed into law a bill that made Oregon only the second state in the country to restrict the operation of older diesel trucks on our roads. But now, since we are in a church, I'm going to get a little preachy. Because today, despite that progress, I'm worried again. There is a climate crisis at hand. And it not only looms large and real in the wildfires that increasingly spoil the splendor of this region and the heat domes that have killed hundreds of Oregonians in just the last few years, but it also seems to begin losing traction in our collective energy. And political priorities, displaced by the lingering malaise of the pandemic and the crisis that has played out on our streets. There are so many real challenges facing us every day. People experiencing houselessness and in the grips of drug addiction demand our leaders' attention. But you and I must continue to mobilize to address the threat we see happening to our environment. I invite you to join Neighbors for Clean Air in our work. There are many ways to address the climate crisis, but few that offer immediate and visible relief, like the fight for clean air in our neighborhoods. Help us clean up the legacy of last century. Eliminate diesel emissions. Build a transportation system that transforms it from the single largest contributor to greenhouse gas and toxic emissions to one that ensures more of us get to where we want to go easier, faster, while less reliant on individual vehicles. And most importantly, join us as we work to ensure the communities who face the biggest burdens from all sources of pollution have the resources and information they need to be strong and resilient in the face of those burdens. I want to tell you, you have a choice. Be overwhelmed, get angry, or do something. The first two are really reactions. The last one is the decision. The hard truth about advocacy is that while it's almost always born on the energy of an angry mob, it's rarely sustained on that. It's sustained by the optimism of its members who believe that change is really possible and the conviction of leaders to stick with it until it happens. Because the big crowds dissipate, elected officials' attention wanes, the reporters quit calling, and you are left again with that decision every day to keep doing something. It's in our personal struggles we can all find our cause. Our federal failures are a crisis of local politics. The effect can be overwhelming, a sense that too much of our life is out of our control. With our republic seemingly on the brink, to save it, we all need to find our something. We all need to find that one thing, to choose something over nothing and choose optimism over anger. Maybe it's daunting to consider starting a whole campaign, running for elected office, leading a movement. That's not necessarily where you start. That can be where the work leads you. You start by finding that reason to believe, and then you use your experience, your unique set of talents, your passion to make a difference. I really believe that if we all just pick that one small thing, the bigger things will come back into alignment. Like for me, fighting global climate change one breath at a time. Thank you very much for this.
The Unitarian Universalist Seventh Principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence, is a glorious statement. Yet we make a profound mistake when we limit it to merely an environmental idea. It is so much more. It is our response to the great dangers of both individualism and oppression. It's our solution to the seeming conflict between the individual and the group. Our seventh principle may be our Unitarian Universalist way of coming to firmly embrace something greater than ourselves. The interdependent web, expressed as the spirit of life, the ground of all being, the oneness of all existence, the community-forming power, the process of life, the creative force, even spirit, can help us develop that social understanding of ourselves that we and our culture so desperately need. It's a source of meaning to which we can dedicate our lives. That's Forrest Gilmore. I'll extinguish the flame, but not the vision and compassion of our faith. May they stay with you until we meet again. Please join us downstairs afterwards for coffee and conversation. I think Mary can hang out, answer questions. And as we join downstairs, we'll also get to celebrate Joe Boyd for his many years of service, doing so many different things for our community. And there will be cake.